Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt, and my guest today is Mark Richard. He's the author, most recently, of a book of short stories called Charity, the author previously of a novel, Fish Boy, and a book of stories, his first, The Ice at the Bottom of the World. The Charity book, the major subject of our conversation today, is available from Doubleday. In hardcover, Fish Boy is now in paperback, as is the first book of short stories. Now, I wanted to begin with the title. What made you want a book of stories called Charity?
Charity is the title of the story that I felt connected with in the book the most. Growing up, the hospitals in which I spent a lot of time were called charity hospitals. And you would often find yourself on charity ward. So for me, charity means a lot more than the dictionary definition of the word.
Now, when you talk about that, the charity ward, you're talking about something that to most Americans and most readers is a Dickensian concept. And when you've written the stories taking place there, like Birds for Christmas or Charity itself, there's a kind of hilarious Dickens quality to these children there who are variously tailed and deformed. But in particular, it's a Scrooge-like Christmas carol scene that you often construct there. Is Dickens a figure for you of considerable influence?
I love Dickens, and I read all of Dickens, and I found when I do describe charity wards, I do describe them as Dickensian. And the appeal is that you have human beings who are sort of stripped down to the fundaments, and especially children, and you notice the look of horror on the visitors' faces as they come through to visit you on special times, which the children will manipulate to get more gifts at Christmas. But children are children, even when they're losing their limbs and when they're decaying in their beds and when they have no face. And I found it a place that, as a child with problems with my own legs and back and hips and knees and everything else and body cast, it was a place where you were not unusual. In fact, you fit right into all these people that you just described. It's always been a good, safe place for me in my own psyche to return to are these Dickensian wards.
One of the things that I love about those particular stories and about the novel Fish Boy, they seem to partake of a science that I didn't know existed. I was looking in the dictionary one day, and I found the word teratology, which is the science of monsters. And there's a glorious feeling in these stories. If approached in the wrong way, they're very disturbing, and I've read those opening paragraphs, particularly of Charity, to people who think they wouldn't be able to stand it, and then to others who can't stop laughing. But for me, there's something hallowed or elevated about this special echoing place of monstrosity that seems to be where a lot of your fiction comes from.
I look back now as an adult, as a 42-year-old man, and see that this is a very important place for my life to begin as a child in a hospital in a full body cast in a very grim place. where you sort of reinvent yourself as a creature in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that's always been part of the thing that defines me as an adult now. I just had my left hip replaced, and I didn't anticipate the emotional aspect of it afterwards when the pain that I'd sort of trudged over for 30-some-odd years is gone. And that pain had defined me in a way that made me who I am today, and now it's gone. And so what do you do? Suddenly you have all this capital of emotion and effort that you've invested in this thing that's in you, and it's gone. And what do you do?
You're listening to Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt, and my guest today is Mark Richard. Now, I would say, at least in American fiction, the kind of redemptive grotesque began with Flannery O'Connor and Nathaniel West. One could go back further, of course, and talk about Hawthorne and others. But I wonder if you think there has been any fictional advance in that material since that time, since O'Connor and West was beginning to handle that dark side of human nature that in both of those writers seems to require some kind of ironic redemption.
We probably have not exhausted it. I don't think that we've finished that work that West and O'Connor are noted for putting us on that track. I don't think we've exhausted it. I think there's probably been some wrong dead ends pursued, but no, I think that there's plenty of ways to go and to make a fictional advance. I'm trying to think why I wrote Fish Boy and what I was looking for in that type of study of the grotesque. And it's, again, I guess it's some spiritual aspect of a search. I remember when I was writing it, I was having a big spiritual turmoil in my own life in which I didn't see a whole lot of anything except the bleak. And yet I could not go on writing unless I thought there was going to be some redemptive aspect of it at the end. I know I wrote Fish Boy for one reason, because there wasn't a book like it, and I wanted to read a book like that. It wasn't out there, so then you have to create it yourself.
Well, one of its great triumphs, it seems to me, is in constructing a weird and lurid beauty out of horrific experience. And the boy himself is always grateful for his bitter experiences, falling through the twiggy hole in an osprey nest. He's happy because he got a really good scratch. His lice bites have never been so well scratched before. And the book is full of this odd celebration of the minimal benefits of the extremely difficult circumstance and the arranging of that circumstance so that it's so colorful. A boy in a nest, a fish boy in a bird's nest. He wakes at one point, or thinks he wakes in a net full of fish eyes and entrails. But by and large, while surreal, the quality conveyed is the wondrous and the beautiful.
Again, I probably am, maybe because I just had the surgery, I'm thinking about some of the things you're saying that directly apply to my state of mind as a child when I was grateful for the small things that alleviate your misery when you're a child in these hospitals. So I don't forget that. I also don't forget that I'm grateful just to be able to walk around and to be alive, and that once you've been in a dark place or in a body cast or any of these places for years or months and years at a time, the world is a wondrous place. I always remember, through childhood, coming out of the doors of the hospital for the first time, being in there for 9 months, and just seeing, you know, a stoplight change and watching it and just being amazed. And maybe I remember those amazements because they were such grand amazements at the time. And in our adult life, especially in the culture in which we live, where we're constantly being amazed by morphing or bus ads or God knows what you read in the paper, we're kind of numb. And maybe that's why some of this, the shock fiction, doesn't work. We're numb to this. I prefer to think that you must seduce the reader back into that place of wonder. And I think that it is a seduction instead of a murder of the reader.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to slightly switch gears because I would say that in the book of stories we're talking about, Charity, by my guest Mark Richard, there is a bonding with the outcast, with the criminal, with the childhood deformity, with the lost druggie. These are the places where the narrative finds a point of identification with the external world. I think one of the things that I noticed in Fish Boy is that the book that is most like it, perhaps, is The Painted Bird. But there we've got a world war to explain this atrocity. These books come from a disturbance in the internal imagination that leads the imagination to find the external world and its outcasts. And it seems to me that it is not without some shocking humor, that you would be not telling the entire truth if you were to suggest that you were purely redemptive. Even Faulkner, writing that chapter of the Hamlet in which an idiot makes love to a cow, is enjoying hugely the enormous love letter to animality that he's writing for
right.
This idiot.
Well, I think you busted me there, and you're absolutely right. The two things, and they go back to the Flannery O'Connor mentioned earlier. She said the two greatest sins are pornography and sentimentality. Mm. And I think that's a very interesting sentence. And also, Flannery O'Connor said that she sent one of her novels to a relative, and the relative replied, "Well, that just shows you how some people will do." And I thought that's, and I know what Flannery O'Connor was, why she chose that to put in her letter to someone else. That's right. So that'll show you what someone who's given what they have will do with what they have. And it's not a judgment call, and I do sort of relish the, don't get me wrong, I enjoy the shock and the horror, but you earn it. And I think that if you earn it in a way, it's not sentimental, which is evoking some unearned emotional response. And it's not necessarily pornographic, where it's just something laid bare without any type of explanation.
Well, I think also it's unavoidable here that what it guarantees the value or quality of the writing, does it come from a truthful and indescribable, otherwise indescribable place? I think that what happens in your stories, it convinces me of their integrity, is that there is such a complicated relation in story after story to a missing father, whether that is in the first story, a punishing father who tells his son while he's away not to throw stones. These stories are again and again about what not to do when the father is absent, and the search for him, which is a kind of search for correction or redemption. And so in several of the stories you have these charity ward children implicitly fatherless. In the longest story in the book, the boys are looking for a father who's made himself into a kind of prophet or idol, speaking a strange language and worshipped by many. He used to be a politician. But that the missing father seems to generate a lot of the inner obsession of these stories. Can you speak about that?
Coming off the last question, I think that I do try to keep these stories honest on that level. I read Gentleman's Agreement, which is about the father forbidding the child to throw a rock again, and of course the child makes a covenant against throwing rocks and does throw another rock to even greater catastrophe. And a rabbi in New York, after the reading, sat down with me and said, "Now, this is the story of Isaac and Abraham, and I'm going to tell you why." And I think he was right. And I get some of these notions from reading out of the Bible, some of the best fiction ever. I don't know if that's blasphemous, I'm sure, but the great stories in the Bible. And when the sermon is a little boring, my preacher would say, "I know my sermon's in trouble," when Richard reaches for the Bible to start flipping through it. And it speaks to me, and it speaks to me on several levels beyond the immediate of my own relationship with my father, which has never been great, but better now that we're older. I think that in our work, we feel that there is that divine something about us. Even as a broken child, you must think there must be a part of God within you. And you go through your life hoping somehow for a reconnection. And the best art that I see in museums, the best music I hear, the best fiction I read, is some way another striving toward the divine. And I know that informs my work in some way, possibly with this. Now that you tell me how many father stories I have, I'll have to look this over again. But yes, it's true. There is some striving for that figure, that thing, that divinity that's just out of reach right now. But maybe it'll be in the next page.
The thing that I want to bring this toward is that the choice, the serious choice of the darkness, has a consequence upon the language of a story. All the writers that we're talking about here, Faulkner, West, Flannery O'Connor, in their choice of the malignant as a subject of fiction and the possibility of its being secretly blessed, something has happened to the language. It's as if there has to be a register in which only these people could speak. And certainly there's a very tortured, gouged out, I see in your stories the presence of words that have been chopped out of sentences. They have, like, they leave shadows on the sentence. One can feel, you know, some kind of carving going on, so that the sentence leaves the mark of its mutilation behind. What is your style? How does it evolve?
I think that I use words that are acoustically correct for the task at hand. There's hundreds of different combinations of words and sentences to describe an event. There are maybe two or three good ways to do it. Now, I've learned that just by modulations and vowels and stresses and we talked about earlier that when researchers have discovered that you can treat autistic children with music therapy, I was very intrigued by that notion, because I know that there are certain sounds and rhythms and cadences that when you put them together, they do evoke emotional responses, even when there are no words applied. Now, this can work in two ways. You can have a nice sounding rhythm high-end staccato line of sound that maybe makes you feel happy and pleasant. And at the same time, the words themselves mean something dark and sinister. And as a young survivor also in a hospital, we're going back to this, but you're looking for the inflections in the doctors' and nurses' voices to see what the real meaning is behind the words they're saying. And you can learn how to seduce or betray or lie or manipulate a listener by the way you form, by the words you choose. And I found that in my work that if I'm not, I read it aloud when I'm working because I go, you know what, the sound of these words isn't correct. It doesn't correctly work with the text. The text is saying one thing and the sound is saying something else, which you can use to affect also, but you really want everything to work together.
I'm going to finally ask Mark Richard to read us a very short story from the collection Charity, published by Doubleday and the Nantelise imprint. Well, you get to say the title.
I don't know if I can read the title, Michael. This is an odd little piece that is, I wasn't sure we were going to include this or not because I'm not sure it's a piece of fiction or not. as a couple of these stories are in here, if I can just digress for a second, the Birds for Christmas was originally an essay for Esquire magazine, and then the project collapsed, and it changed into fiction in the messenger's pouch on the way to the New Yorker without changing a word of the text. This is a piece on insomnia, and I think it's just one sentence. Someone pointed out to me at a reading the other night, but the title is, as you would see it appear in a real estate classified ad, charming one-bedroom French door windows, quiet, safe, fee. There are actually two sentences, and here's the first complete sentence. Insomnia is easy. When you get insomnia, you open the French door windows to the apartment you cannot afford and sight down on the riffraff on the corner selling drugs with your loaded .38 Smith & Wesson airweight, and you squeeze on the trigger just enough to scare yourself. Or you call the payphone they are all standing around and make vicious remarks from your dark perch about their appearance, their clothes, their grooming, the way they grab their dicks. Or you can fill condoms with water and sling them at the drunken gangster patrons of the pasta place diagonally under your apartment as they come out screaming some boisterous gangster rubbish, knotting up their ties in cheap gangster fashion, shadowboxing the terrified, immaculate Chilean parking garage attendant next door to the gangster pasta place. The way they straighten his tie too tight, lifting him from his green plastic chair, sending him off to fetch their Buick, two of the drunken gangster guys wrapping themselves in the long garage door chains, breathing to break them across their chest, chewing the links in their mouths, growling gladiators chained to fight bears, while a third gangster turns on the garden hose the immaculate Chilean uses to wash the piss and vomit of previous gangster patrons off the sidewalk. The third gangster spraying passing cars with the hose, daring them to stop. Crouching between parked cars, he hoses down a passing couple, unarmed people who dare not turn and face six or seven drunken gangster guys. And then, in insomnia, you lean out naked and swing the water-gorged, reservoir-tipped, and tied-off latex condom a couple of times out the French door windows of the apartment you cannot afford. You swing the condom back and forth, building trajectory. Then you let it go and peek, while it sails upwardly, spastically, like a happy fat girl's breasts bubbling in the top of her cheap, low-cut cotton summer dress as she laughs, bouncing high-heeled down subway steps. You, marveling at the wonderful dynamics of these dualities, the elasticity, the abundance, the constraint, this vulgar, water-stretched latex mockery with its reservoir-tipped nipple sails high over the sidewalk, and then begins its descent. And it doesn't strike the gangster with a hose or the two playing Spartacus in the chains. It doesn't actually strike any of the gangsters. It explodes on the sidewalk, sopping the big man gangster shoes and cuffs, sending the gangster suddenly looking up, looking up, looking up, not seeing anything up there, and dropping the hose, shrugging off the chains, shouting at each other, the big man gangster calm but seething. One of the little gangsters mopping the big man's shoes with a handkerchief. Sorry, 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 boss. The big man, having tolerated this drunken child's play, now finds himself surrounded by idiots, pistol-packing idiots, supposed to dive in front of the Don to take slugs, can't even take a water balloon. And one of the gangster brutes, to do something, examines the water on the pavement, looking for clues to the guy we're going to get for doing this, Big Don, boss. Yeah, he taps around in the water pattern on the sidewalk, sensing the water pattern, something to tell him, because he's a microsecond from pulling out his B.O. Plenty Tech 9 on the creep. And then he sees, with heartbroken familiarity, the broken condom. And before he even thinks, he's saying, "Look it, a rubber." And the big man kicks the scrap of latex out into the street, his beautiful shoe barely missing the face of the man squatting by him. And the Chilean brings down the Buick. They shove him around and point to the roof, shove him around some more, throw a clutch of bills at his green plastic chair, Chinese fire drill themselves into the humped Buick sitting low with cheap-suited muscle, peeling out fast at first and then slowing, passing, one last look out the car windows at the rooftops along the street, their eyes looking high above you, you in your naked insomnia, in your dark, wide-flung French door windows to the apartment you will never in your life be able to afford. You grab your dick at them. You give them the finger. You spit at them. And when they are gone, you sit and wait on the corner of the bed, playing with the pistol, waiting for the trash truck, the bakery, a robbery, the dawn.
Mark Richard reading Charming One-Bedroom, French Door, Windows, Quiet, Safe, Fee from his collection Charity, published by Doubleday. Thank you for being with me today, Mark.
Thank you, Michael.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is J.C. Swadek. Special production assistance today by Alan Howard and development by Beverly Walker. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Make you laugh and say, books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with Book of the Mouse, Mouse Time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.